You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
We were the child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hey, welcome to episode 13 of the Untaming Podcast. I really hope you liked last week's episode with Dr. Sarah Buckley on our hormonal blueprint. A talk with one of my favourite specialists on one of my favourite topics. I certainly enjoyed it. Next week, I will talk to environmental journalist Jennifer Grayson. We talk about her book Unlatched, the history of breastfeeding, the environmental effects of formula feeding, and why we need to stop saying breast is best. Today's episode, it has had my quickest turnaround. We only recorded this last week. But Ollie Langridge is a climate emergency protester. He has been outside New Zealand Parliament every single day for, as of today, 100 days. When I told people I was interviewing a climate emergency protester, I was very surprised to receive the response, "Why? What does that have to do with children?" If you follow the Untaming Facebook page or Instagram account, you may have seen Ollie's sign that reads, "For our children, declare a climate change emergency now. The health of the planet has everything to do with children. It's their future." I'm sure some of the practices that I present in this podcast may come across as a bit hippie-ish, but one of the big reasons I implement these practices, besides them being optimal for our children, is because they are optimal for our planet. We are currently in a climate crisis, and something we can do as parents is raise our children in ways that are healthy for the planet. If you like this episode with Ollie, I have another episode on the climate crisis coming up in a couple of weeks, where we go even deeper into the climate issues than we do today. I didn't want to overwhelm you with two climate episodes back to back, so stay tuned for that one with Kirk Hall 2 weeks from now. It'll certainly knock your socks off. For now, let's hear from Ollie. Ollie Langridge was born in London in the United Kingdom, grew up in a small village outside London, and currently lives in Wellington, New Zealand with his wife, Natalia. He has five living children, Leo, Sasha, Kai, Alex and Anna, who range in ages from 2 to 23 years. Ollie studied at the University of Derby and is self-employed as the director of an international creative services company, the Moon United Limited. Since the 14th of May this year, Ollie has been sitting outside in front of New Zealand's Parliament every single day holding a sign protesting for the government to declare a climate change emergency. Keeping in mind we are in the southern hemisphere, so this is the middle of winter. Using a laptop and Parliament's free Wi-Fi, Ollie is able to continue working, but with the support of his family, he has pledged to remain there every single day, regardless of the weather, until the emergency is declared. Last night he had 8 hours of sleep, and for breakfast today he had some porridge with some oat milk and a smoothie with hemp protein, nuts and greens he has grown himself. Ollie, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for inviting me. Thank you so much. Yes. Hi. A couple of things there. I don't grow the nuts and hemp protein myself, just the silver beet. Yeah. The company is called the Moon Unit, not the Moon United. That sounds like a football club.
Oh, it is too. Sorry.
So thank you for having me on board. Yes, and a pleasure to talk to you.
So Ollie, you have said yourself that you are just a normal guy. Your Instagram handle is That Humble Man, and only because that normal man and that ordinary man were already taken. So tell us about your background. Have you always been an environmental advocate? What prompted you to do this and why are you doing it?
Yeah, sure thing. So give my age away. Well, I suppose you told people that already. Way back in 1989, when the Discovery Channel, who were then a nature documentary channel primarily, came into London, into the UK market, and I was the very first editor when the team was probably about maybe 20 people launching that TV channel. It was my job to put interstitial elements in between their programming. Interstitials meaning just sort of like nice cuts set to music of this, that, and the other. And of course, it was a fantastic education in the natural world, very, very fast education. So it's always sort of like been with me, this whole real world. I'm really into outdoor experiences and being in nature, tramping, surfing, meditation outside, stuff like that. Being in nature is that always good for me. So when I saw what was happening with the climate in the 90s and the early 2000s and no one doing anything about it, it sort of like started to set off these kind of warning bells for me in the back of my mind, so to speak. And fast forward to 2019, this had kind of reached a kind of boiling point, as I've seen in retrospect, when in May this year, the United Nations released their environmental report on biodiversity, telling us that a million species were going to go extinct in the very near future unless we changed our ways radically, and we were losing species at about 200 every day. And I just freaked out, not literally. I just literally got up from my desk, and I'd always been one of these people who was a collectivist. I'd like stuff and donate and share and, you know, do all those usual things. And yes, I drive an EV and I grow as many of my own vegetables as I can. So self-sufficient 3 months of the year, and just do all the normal things like you do, right? I'm a vegan, and it was just not enough. So I went, I left my office. I just walked out and went to a hardware store and got some paint and some wooden signs together, painted up my placard and sat myself down on the lawn in front of New Zealand Parliament and just I wanted to see what would happen.
So you have also said that you don't affiliate yourself with any political party or organisation. Can you explain how what you're doing is different to the global Extinction Rebellion movement?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm aware of Extinction Rebellion. I'm aware of, say, Greenpeace and 350 and other organisations. But I'm not affiliated with any of those people or any of those groups. I'm just an average suburban dad. I'm not politically affiliated either. For me, this is something that I just think is like way above party politics. It's an existential humanitarian crisis we're facing. And although I like what the of certain groups are doing, I think it's better if I just remain fairly vanilla at the moment, for want of a better phrase. In that way, the media can't really dig their knives into you or, you know, find ways to put you down. And people, I think, particularly trolls who you find online, are looking for ways in which they can just debunk you and just say, oh, look at that guy. He's a climate change protester, but he's got like 5 kids. Ha, ha, ha. Look, he's got, you know, a polyester jacket on. Ha, ha, and all that. What an idiot. Look, he's all these things that kind of come out. The reason I'm not with XR is one of those things. OK, so XR, I love what they did in London. And if I was living in a larger, more country with more people around where you have to do bigger actions to make more noise, then I would certainly be a part of that movement. But I think perhaps there's two things there. Firstly, we do things a little bit differently in New Zealand. And secondly, perhaps if I was with any known political group or pseudo-political group, as the media would see that, then they'd go, oh, look, he's with this group. You know, they're the group that, like, held up London. My brother was phoning me and, you know, he lost 15,000 a day from his shop because people couldn't get there because it was blockaded and all that kind of thing. He's just one of those, you know, left-wing socialist loonies and stuff. So very early on, I thought, look, I'm just going to be here and come here as honestly from the heart as a dad with no affiliations and see what happens.
Oh, good on you. So the UK, Ireland, Canada, France, the Vatican, and most recently Argentina have already declared climate change emergencies. Yet collectively, they still give billions to the coal, oil, and gas industries. So even if New Zealand does declare an emergency, what impact do you hope the declaration will achieve?
Yeah, I get asked this question about 10 times a day. You can imagine I've been outside standing in front of Parliament for 92 days now, consecutive days. And yeah, I've been asked that question a lot. So going back a little step here, yeah, it's massively disappointing that people say climate change emergency and then they fund oil pipelines like Trudeau does in Canada, or, you know, then they fund new fossil fuel initiatives like they have in most of the countries you've mentioned. It just makes you kind of wring your hands and go, you've got to be absolutely kidding. Declaration of a climate change emergency. For some people, they see that as empty virtue signaling. It's like a nod in the right direction. But, you know, if there's no policies or legislation around, well, why would you bother? And this is, in fact, what the National Party here in New Zealand are thinking at the moment. This is the kind of where they stand on the matter. And to counter that argument, what I say is, look, if the house is on fire, and if you know Greta Thunberg and what she says with using this phraseology, you'll already know this. If your house is on fire, you make sure people are aware of it. You set off the alarm. You tell people the truth about what's going on, that we're up against something that we need to act on very urgently, far more urgently than we previously supposed because of the climate scientists. This is what they're telling us. And then we don't sit around talking what we're going to rebuild first or what insurance policies we're going to do. We put the fire out. And declaration of a climate change emergency is simply that. It might on one hand be symbolic, but on the other, it's a very powerful message from government to the people that actually we're aware that there's an emergency and we're going to do something about it. And hopefully here in New Zealand, without funding multi-million dollar oil pipelines or allowing new oil drilling permits.
I know very little about parliamentary procedures. What is the difference between the emergency declaration coming from Parliament, Cabinet or Government?
Well, I'm glad you say that, actually, Emily, because when I stepped out on that lawn, I didn't even know who the leader of the opposition was. Such as my disdain or disinterest for politics, this, as I say, is like something that's above party politics. See it as something which is just, as I say, you know, just a humanitarian crisis we've got to be aware of and stop waving your flags, be it green or yellow or blue or whatever. You know, this is crazy. This is like way above party politics. So what you have is a government declaration and a parliament declaration. Mm-hmm. So here in New Zealand, we have a coalition government made up of three parties. That is the majority Labour Party and then two minority parties, the Greens and a party called NZ First. They form a coalition government. If the government wants to make a climate change emergency declaration, it would have to get the buy-in or the sign-off from all those three political parties, then they would have a majority and they would push that through. A parliamentary climate change emergency declaration would be all parties in the House doing that, which would then include the National Party.
Okay. I first heard about you when you made national headlines for breaking the record as the longest running protester outside Parliament, clocking up 74 days. And today, when we're recording, is 92, and the day this episode airs will mark 100 days. You have said yourself this is not an accolade you ever wanted, all of these days wasted when we could have been actually doing something towards mitigating the climate crisis. I understand one of the major holdups is that the National Party, one of our country's major political parties, does not even believe that there is an emergency. So with so much evidence from the United Nations, the IPCC, and agreement from 97% of the world's top climate scientists, how can there still be people, especially ones running a country, who are denying that there is any emergency?
Well, I was hoping you'd tell me that, actually, Emily, because it's completely confusing. You know, I stand there day after day thinking, how is this possible? It's like, you know, here's the analogy, right? There's this politician in the middle of the road, and there's this truck, really big truck, hurtling towards him, right? Mm. And happens to be a scientist walking past, right? And the scientist shouts to the politician, whoa, watch out, mate. There's this huge truck hurtling towards you. And the politician looks round at the truck, and he goes, no, there isn't. Oh, is it something in the water? Have I stepped into some parallel universe here? You know, it's like, how is this possible? That people aren't listening to the scientists. You know, I've got we've got people here in New Zealand, the top 50 or God knows how many now, 200 scientists are saying, you must do this. This is like way above politics. It's completely crazy. Mm. In answer to your earlier question, yeah, TV1 interviewed me on day 74. And the way they framed it was just hilarious. It was like, oh, wow, Ollie, here you are live on the lawn. You know, I was on breakfast television. They're like, you've just broken the record for the longest protest outside New Zealand Parliament. And I'm like, how do you feel? And they're like, what? It's like I'm some like swimming champion or something. You know, it's like, oh, my God, no way. This is just crazy. The last thing I wanted was when I came out here. I had no expectations because you can't, right? But I just never thought I'd be out here 74 days. It's not an accolade I ever wanted. It's crazy, and it's really sad. And honestly, Emily, what I most want most of all after this is just to be able to disappear from the public eye, because I don't like cameras stuck in my face and all that kind of thing. Politicians tend to be ego driven, and I'm a yoga teacher. I'm the opposite of that. I let go of yoga. Ego is let go of ego, rather. It's just unnecessary muscle tension. Politicians could really do with a little dose of that, you know. And it's kind of crazy the way things have panned down and suddenly come to this political gridlock here.
Yes. It's like the attention has been on the wrong thing. They're making out about how long you've been there rather than on the actual issue, which it must be just so frustrating.
Well, it is. It's completely crazy, you know. And especially when the young people are asking for this, the youth parliament are wanting it. They've declared it, rather. Multiple cities and regional councils across New Zealand have declared it. The top 50 scientists. It's just by June the 15th, they did a Colmar Brunton poll, and that was like months ago, where the majority of New Zealanders then wanted a climate change emergency declaration. And that was before Auckland, Wellington, and Dunedin declared it. So, wow, you know, what is that now? We talk to people in MFE. Which is the Ministry for the Environment, they're counting the votes for the zero carbon bill and the submissions, and they're saying, look, over 90% of people are saying 2050 is far too long, it's never enough, come on, get a grip, let's go faster than this.
Yeah.
They want change. The remaining 9 or 10% are people who are big emitters from the agricultural sector.
The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has reported on the impacts of global warming above 1.5 degrees. And I remember when I first heard about this a few years ago, I thought, 1.5 degrees, how much of an impact can that really make? I can't feel the difference between 20 degrees and 21.5, but I've since learned that there's a lot more to it than that. Could you clarify the 1.5 degree target for us?
Look, I'm not a climate change scientist, and I'm not a scientist per se at all. So I would really like to not really go too deeply into this. There's a lovely guy called Professor James Renwick, who is one of New Zealand's primary climate change scientists. He's actually speaking on day 100 at this vigil, and he's regularly contributes to IPCC, and he's very approachable. 1.5 degrees is sort of a bit of a joke, because we're way, way, way behind what that is. It's not like the difference between today's a 25 degree centigrade day and it's 26.5. You're not going to notice the difference, right? As you said earlier. So it's like 1.5 degrees of global warming traps an immense amounts of heat that can't escape through the atmosphere. We're dumping zillions of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, and we think we're able to stop it without any kind of consequences, like it's a video game or something. But, you know, the consequences are horrendous. This means that 2 degrees, as I understand it, already indicates we've lost all the coral reefs and 1 million species. 4 degrees would be people cannot now live in the tropical areas of the world whatsoever. And are forced to live in either Canada, Alaska, or Siberia, or in the Southern Hemisphere, the West Antarctic, Tasmania, South Island of New Zealand, and Patagonia. We're currently headed for about 4.4.
Wow. And is that if we continue on as business as usual?
Yeah, that's right. And people in New Zealand, they say, oh, you know, global warming. Okay, so what 1.5 degrees, what does that mean? Or, you know, the people who don't get it at all, they look at me wrapped up in a coat in the rain. They go, ha ha, global warming. Look at that idiot wrapped up in a coat. What they, you know, and the ones that do get it, they're like, some of them are like, oh, intelligent people. And they go, well, if I don't use plastic bags and plastic straws and all that kind of thing, then, you know, I'm going to save the planet. And, you know, it's like, oh, wow, okay. And then you get people that they get it a little bit more. But when they think sea level rise, and when they think, yes, there's going to be more droughts and more floods, that's great. But what no one is talking about is refugees. When climate packs up completely in South Asia and Southeast Asia and the equatorial latitudes of the world, there will be hundreds of millions of people displaced, desperate and displaced, looking for somewhere to go. And that is a really scary scenario.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I have seen that you've suffered a lot of criticism for your protest. A lot of it does come from the ignorant. Though I've seen the remark that there are better ways to make a difference than standing outside with a sign, such as picking up rubbish, planting trees, educating people about the environment. How do you respond to this? Does it make you rethink your protest?
Well, that's funny. So picking up rubbish off the street, off beaches, planting trees, I do all that. I planted over 1,000 trees last year, planted over 1,000. And that's kind of a regular thing. Yes, I drive an EV, I grow my own vegetables. I'm a vegan. I talk to people about climate change. But there's a certain number of people that unfortunately are either in denial or just, well, they just won't admit to what's happening. It's either like chemtrails or it's government controlling, like, you know, high altitude radar. It's all a government plot, or it's a socialist hoax. You know, that's the big one. You know, it's like it's me invoking mass hysteria in young people. And you know, when I'm standing out there on the lawn in front of Parliament, I'm not going anywhere. And particularly in the early days, it got really hard because I was like a magnet for people who just wanted to have a go. They just wanted to vent. You know, they were screaming flat earth in my face, or, you know, it was sunspots, or it was this, that, or the other, you know. And it got really, really hard the first couple of weeks in particular, where the unhinged and the unstable wanted to have a place to just vent at me. It was pretty crazy back then. So, look, in terms of a response, when someone comes up, you've got to really kind of look at them and see if they're going to be someone who's a supporter or someone who's a denier, and then act appropriately. Online is worst, where you get threats and foul language and, you know, the worst kind of trolling you can imagine. Yeah, it's horrendous, but you can't let that affect you.
No, good on you. Can we delve more into what sort of ecological practice you're implementing personally for yourself and for your family?
Ecological practice? How would you like to frame that? How
do you... Any sort of like environmentally friendly practices, I guess, that...
Okay, yeah, sure. So as individuals, there were two, maybe three, let's count it as three things we can really do to make a big, big difference immediately. First is diet. I know there's a lot of people that don't like the concept of being vegan. I am a vegan. However, I will eat one piece of fish once a month, just to say I'm not like 100% vegan. And, you know, because I really enjoy it, I really look forward to it. And that's actually coming up next week. I hardly wait. So, you know, I'm not heavier than thou. Like, I'm sort of like, I don't eat any land meat, certainly no beef or pork or chicken or anything like that. I haven't done for a long, long time. And that's something we can do with individual food choices. If you're not a vegan, if you're not a meat eater, then just like maybe just check it out. If you eat it just once a week, is your health going to like suffer? No, actually, you'll see amazing differences. But let's not get into the whole dietary thing. Second thing is flying. Planes dump tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. About 10 days ago, there was the busiest ever day with the most flights ever recorded on the planet. And it was about 230,000 flights in one day or something crazy like that. And if you just imagine the amount of CO2 that's dumping into the atmosphere, it is just preposterous. And if you can possibly not fly and just travel by train or bus or just whatever you can do to try and avoid it, that's another major difference we can make. So it's something I try and do. I do drive an electric vehicle, have done for about a year and a half. The jury's out on the, you know, the carbon footprint of making the vehicles in the first place versus the CO2 being emitted.
Yeah.
Personally, if I'm powering that on 100% renewables with a company called Ecotricity here in New Zealand, where that's all wind and solar generated or thermal. So there's very little environmental impact from actually running that vehicle, which is fantastic. Yeah. If you've never owned an EV, oh my God, they're amazing. The torque is ridiculous. I drive a van and it's just so overpowered. I regularly, you know, take on boy races at the lights. I can't help myself. But so there's that. Okay, right. The other side is I grow a lot of vegetables myself, be as self-sufficient as I can. Mm-hmm. In summertime, particularly, I'm eating a lot of soups and salads and smoothies. And I can pretty much exist off just a tiny piece of land for about 3 months a year, which is great. Winter gets a little bit harder, obviously. I don't have any, like, hot houses or anything. My kids don't drink cow milk at all, and they are vegan pretty much. Well, they'll eat a piece of fish occasionally, like me, when I do. But apart from that, we're trying to keep things as low impact as possible. And then you've got all your sort of what George Monbiot calls your micro-consumerist bollocks, you know, like obsessions with plastic straws and bags and stuff like that, which is all very, very good. But, you know, that's not the main thing here. The main thing here is much, much bigger. We have to stop the emissions and we have to stop what's causing climate change. And ultimately, we have to look at the political systems that we're living under.
So you were talking about the travelling and the flights and the emissions. And so you're from the UK. Do you have any plans to go back, or is this going to be your permanent home?
Well, I've lived in New Zealand for 23 years, and so I do identify as a New Zealander. And do I go back to the UK is the question. Yes, I do. And I try to minimize that. I don't have too much family there. I have my mother still there. We're busy on Skype every week. And so there's a very, very good level of contact there. Apart from that, not really traveling that much. And if I do, if I had to, then I guess it would be for a big event, like, say, a funeral that was direct family.
Right, yeah. Okay, so as an ordinary guy before this all began, you've suddenly been thrust into the spotlight. You have five living children, and I'm sure you get asked this a lot, so I'd like to give you a chance to respond. What do you have to say about overpopulation?
Yes, you know, I get asked that a lot as well. Overpopulation is a really interesting one. So currently we've got a lot of people on the planet, and they're very unevenly distributed around the planet. What I need to watch out for when people say, oh, it's just overpopulation, is ultimately between the lines, the subtext there is, we can live however we want here in New Zealand. It's not us that's the problem. We are only 0.17 of the world's pollution. Go and protest outside the Chinese embassy or the Indonesian embassy or the Indian embassy, where they've got zillions and zillions of people. That's the problem. So I find that to be sort of fairly thinly disguised form of racism myself. Where we can live however we want because we're privileged, generally white people, it's those guys' problem, not our problem. Look what they're doing to us. You get what I mean?
Yes, so yeah.
You have to kind of like wheedle out a little bit when people start talking about overpopulation as exactly what they mean. Secondly, if you look at the use of resources in the world, you'll see that the top 1%, the richest 1% of the population, are actually using 25% of all the stuff in the world through all the stuff that we do and we take for granted, you know, driving wherever we want to drive, eating whenever we want, flying wherever we want, going on holidays wherever we want, doing all those things that first world people generally think that they have earned through honest endeavor and their working life.
So where are these 1% who are using up the top, what did you say, 25% of our resources?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're sort of part of that 1%. And if we're not 1%, top 1%, then we're the sort of like percent below that. You know what I mean? If you're, if you've got a bank account and you've got a steady regular job and you live in the OECD, then you're pretty much in that percentage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You have been making daily posts on Facebook, keeping your supporters updated on your protest. In one of your posts, you mentioned a new book you've read, and it had a plot very similar to How I Fear the Not Too Distant Future Will Look. Can you share with us some more about Tim Jones's novella, Where We Land?
Oh, yeah, it's a very dark book. So if you're a listener to this, then please do beware. It's not a great read. It's set in a kind of mythical near future where global heating has gone unchecked. Vast areas of the central parts of the planet are uninhabitable, and New Zealand is getting swamped with climate collapse refugees. In this instance, from Bangladesh, there's a Bangladesh boat on its last legs within sight of the New Zealand coastline, and a New Zealand Navy gunboat comes out and torpedoes it and then machine guns the survivors who have taken to lifeboats. One lone survivor then manages to make it to shore, and then the story starts. Bleak, right?
Yeah.
What can I say? Yeah, it's having a very dark day, because when you sort of like getting into climate collapse, climate crisis stuff, particularly within social media, be that Twitter or the news or wherever you get your stuff from, it tends to become an echo chamber. Mm-hmm. And it just things come back louder and you go, oh, my God, we're really stuffed. Oh, my God, look at this. and the Arctic's on fire, you know, and all the glaciers are melting, and all the polar bears are dying. And oh my God, you know what I mean? It's like you sort of like get into a place where it becomes very difficult to. My wife tells me I've lost my sense of humor. And I sometimes think, yeah, absolutely, because once you kind of see this stuff, it's very difficult to unsee it or unknow it. And if I can read this and I can see this, well, why is everybody being so apathetic? And that can kind of lead you to some dark places sometimes.
Yeah. Does that make you, do you worry that then you come across as an alarmist or as like a prepper?
Yeah, there's always going to be that danger because people are going to say, ah, no, you know, this is going to happen in like 200 years or it might affect our grandchildren. You know, just let me do one and live whatever I want, you know, however I want. And it's not something that's going to affect us. And, you know, I'm causing anxiety within people and stuff. And, you know, actually, I don't spout science at people. I don't say, oh, if 2 degrees does this, it's 4 degrees does this. All I want and all I'm calling for is the single-minded proposition of just declaring a climate change emergency. Yeah. That's it. Without getting too heavy about it, without having like, you know, death narratives or we're all going to die and, you know, all these kind of things that like groups like Extinction Rebellion sometimes do. They pour blood all over the pavements and they have like die-ins in front of stations and block roads and stuff like that. For me, I want to paint a picture of the future is a place that's kind of bright and optimistic, that we can actually change as a species, and it's not too late to do so, that we can actually get to a better place where we're more attuned to the world. We're not in the yoke of this hideous system that demands endless growth on a finite planet. We've actually got over that as a species. We have come together, and humans, when they come together, are capable of amazing, amazing things. You know, and I'm always going to believe that. So I'm there for optimism and hope. And that's contagious.
Are there any misconceptions about your protest that you'd like to quell?
I don't know.
I guess a lot of it does have to do with what we've already talked about today, with people. I guess you've got the deniers, or you've got the people who don't think you're doing the right thing by protesting, that you should do something else. Is there anything like that, because I guess you're seeing people come up to you every day who are negative people, but then I guess you've also got positive people coming up to you as well, don't you?
Well, look, honestly, Emily, the best thing about standing outside of Parliament, which I didn't get beforehand, was that people have come up to me from all over New Zealand, all corners of the country, from over 60, maybe even 70 countries right now, saying thank you so much for what you're doing.
Wow.
People come up and they just spontaneously hug you. They want to talk. Some of them are in anxiety. Some of them are even grieving. Some of them are like happy because something's happening. And all of them are sharing the same opinion. So if there's any misconceptions about what I'm doing, actually, no, not really. I'm just like an apolitical dad. I think this is just above party politics. I think it's like when you're in this kind of state of environmental breakdown and ecological disaster, you've got to be able to do something, really. And in the words of David Attenborough, I think he says something like, look, if I could look my grandchildren in the eyes and say, look, I tried my best, would I be able to do that? And I would have to say, well, yeah, damn, I'm trying.
Mm. What can people do in other parts of New Zealand and also in other nations to help declare a climate change emergency?
Yeah, good question. In order to do that, I think that we can actually just become aware, educate yourself about what's happening, and watch out for pseudoscience. Watch out for stuff that is fake news in terms of the sciences. There's plenty of that being put out, which is another conversation. Make sure that the facts you get are from the United Nations or NASA or from the IPCC. And if they're not, just be very careful where you source your facts, because otherwise you get into what I'd say compromised situations where people go, oh, no, but my expert versus your expert and all that kind of thing. So anyway, so that's the first thing, education. Secondly, once you see that and you can't really unsee it, as I say, you just start to mobilize and you have to start to find like-minded people. That might be through groups like Greenpeace or 350 or Extinction Rebellion or others, people who can speak the same language because they understand the same issues. and they're super seriously worried about stuff, and like inevitably that would lead to. So yeah, I guess that's it really. You just start to live in tune with nature, some of the stuff we discussed earlier in this interview. Also, and actually start to look at the way our political systems are set up. I think it's the very definition of madness that we've got a system that demands endless growth on a finite planet. But of course, as soon as I say those kind of things, you know, people label me as a political agitator or as a socialist or something. But, you know, it's like, well, how do we define wealth? Do we define that via GDP? I think that's crazy. You know, let's define it by well-being or how many fantastic unspoiled areas or clean rivers or natural forests or national parks that we have. Those are wealth far beyond what we call GDP. And a system to have like growth, like if you say, for example, you're saying, I just want 3% growth this year. Well, in 24 years, that's like double. And we've already hit environmental and ecological boundaries. What do you want? You want more and more and more and more again? Well, we can't do that. We're in a death loop, if you think that. It's the economics of the deluded. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what are you going to do after day? Well, what's going to happen on day 100, and then what are your plans for after that?
Okay. So day 100, we're getting a slightly different strategy together. We'll see a major gathering with speeches from scientists and MPs. Mm-hmm. And from then there'll be maybe 1,000 people. This is on Friday the 23rd of August, which is, I think, the day you mentioned this is coming out.
Yes.
The news will tell. From then on in, the protests will ramp up a notch. Instead of a thin line of people on the lawn every day visibly, what we'll do is we'll follow the Fridays for Future lead in other countries and turn up in numbers once a week. Leading up to the next school strikes for climate and beyond, just keeping that pressure on. And there's going to be dozens of us, hundreds of us there every single Friday outside Parliament. And that's what we'll do going forward. And then you know what I want most of all after the declaration is just to disappear from the public eye, because I see myself as a suburban dad. I'm a normal, regular guy. I do not want to be a figurehead or in any way in the limelight. And I just I just want my life back.
Yeah. I will put links in the show notes to your Facebook page, your Instagram account, and the resources we've talked about today. Where else can people go to learn more or to help support your protest?
So I have an Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, hashtag that humble man or at that humble man. Mm-hmm. And gosh, what else? Well, there's other resources around, which I won't mention here. I think I've said a few.
Mm-hmm. Ollie, you're away from your family every single day. I'm sorry to have taken you away from them even more today. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me. Do you have any final words of wisdom you would like to finish with?
Look, thank you for your time, Emily. Finally, all I'd say is amor vincit omnia, which means love conquers everything. Keep hope, keep the faith. Like I say, humans are capable of absolutely amazing things when we can pull together. And I think we can do this.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favourite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.